Welcome back to Rockstock Channel. It is Thursday, March 27th, and we are privileged to have today my good friend, Tazo Arima, founder, managing director, and CEO of Hyperion X. We've talked in recent years about the influx of Crocodile Dundee Australian mining entrepreneurs into the North American lithium space. But like so much about visionary entrepreneurs, Tazo is always many, many years ahead of his time. I was lucky enough to meet Tazo in 2010 when he was just 28 years old and became part of his first billion-dollar success, Coalspur, a thermal coal story in Alberta, Canada, currently supplying Korea and other Asian countries. 6 years later, in 2016, he saw a future in lithium, and having heard me pitching what is today's Thacker Pass over those 6 years, he called me to help raise seed funding and find a CEO for a property he picked up in North Carolina that at the time had just 400 acres and 19 drill holes mineralized with plain vanilla spodumene. 4 years later, in September 2020, Piedmont Lithium signed a spodumene offtake deal with Tesla, catalyzing its rise to become Tazo's second unicorn and garnering front page coverage in the Wall Street Journal. Soon thereafter, Piedmont's neighbor, Albemarle, began an all-out process to restart its Kings Mountain mine, which used to account for 100% of lithium produced globally, a vision Tazo saw when he originally started Piedmont. That same month in September 2020, Tazo quietly listed his next and most ambitious critical mineral and metal vision, titanium, at 12 cents on the ASX. Today, 42 months and 20 bags later, at $2.25, Hyperion X sits at more than 500 million Australian dollar market cap. Tazo has assembled a tier one board and management team, brand name customers, suppliers, strong institutional investor and investment banking support, as well as, crucially, the U.S. government. Hyperion X is the largest opportunity and greatest ambition of Tazo's career. And unlike Coalspur and Piedmont, which he founded but then sought a CEO to run, Tazo's approached Hyperion X using his full capabilities learned from previous companies and is running the company as CEO himself. To date, Hyperion X has raised nearly 100 million Aussie dollars through five equity raises led by B. Riley, Canaccord, Bell Potter, and Ord Minnett, and anchored by institutional investors, Fidelity Management, Fidelity International, and other major instos and high net worth investors. The company has also secured nearly $13 million grant from the Department of Defense and a letter of intent for $11 million in equipment financing from the U.S. Export-Import Bank. In addition to its ASX listing, Hyperion X has ADRs trading on NASDAQ, same ticker, IPX. Rockstock Channel featured Hyperion X through its equity overview series in early 2022, which followed my partner Rodney Hooper publishing the first research note about the company in November 2021. Canaccord's Red Spencer discussed in our interview last week his February 23rd coverage initiation and $3.60 target price for Hyperion X.
I'd probably highlight, Howard, that our valuation is heavily risked as well, given that I guess the company is yet to move from pilot scale to commercial scale production, and that will happen over the next couple of years, as you say.
Bell Potter, which we will reference a bit in this video, similarly initiated coverage on March 19th with a $3.70 target. The titanium industry, like the lithium industry, is critical to the U.S., and is not well understood by many outside the industry. There's a lot of technical knowledge and competitive advantage that Hyperion X's disruptive technology offers that we won't be able to cover in this single interview. We have put a number of links in the description to Hyperion X's corporate presentation, shareholder letter, and half-yearly report. But if you'd like more information, including research reports referenced in this video, please reach out to me directly through our new email, rockstockchannel@rkequity.com. To see all extended cuts and early releases, please join us at patreon.com/rockstockchannel for just $10 a month. And don't forget, if you like this video, please like, subscribe, and leave a comment. And remember, we have been advisors and hold equity interests in Hyperion X, but nothing in this video should be construed as financial advice. Like Elon Musk, Tazo has a big, hairy, audacious goal, summarized in the company's mission statement. Hyperion X aims to be a leading American producer of titanium alloys, titanium products, and critical minerals. We plan to reshore in the USA an end-to-end titanium supply solution underpinned by a range of patented titanium technologies that have demonstrated the ability to make high-performance titanium products from either titanium metal scrap or titanium mineral feedstocks. In addition to our metals technologies, Hyperion X also holds 100% interest in the Titan Project, located near Camden, Tennessee, one of the largest titanium, zircon, and rare earth mineral resources in the United States. Reading this mission and knowing Tazo nearly 15 years, a more serious pop culture icon than Crocodile Dundee comes to my mind. Hank Reardon, the main protagonist in Ayn Rand's masterpiece, Atlas Shrugged. Thank you to Cliff Notes for this succinct character analysis. Through 10 years of prestigious efforts, he created a new metal alloy far superior than steel. His productivity is legendary. Productivity is the adaptation of nature to man's survival needs. It involves the creation of goods and services that human life requires. The mind is the source of all wealth, the means by which man creates economic value and reshapes the physical environment. The ability of the mind to create material abundance for the purpose of enjoying life on Earth. In January of this year, Tazo, Hank Reardon Arima, wrote in his annual shareholder letter that a Bessemer moment is upon us in titanium. From 5 years, from 1853 to 1858, the inventor, Henry Bessemer, discovered and commercialized a new, low-cost process for producing steel. The first commercial Bessemer steel plant in the U.S. was built in 1864, and in the 15 years from 1867 and 1882, U.S. production of Bessemer steel grew 53% annually, while costs were reduced by 70%, ushering in a new age in steel production, driving an industrial revolution for over 150 years. Hyperion X's core titanium refining and processing technology, hydrogen-assisted metallothermic reduction, or HAMR, and hydrogen sintering and phase transformation, HSPT, were first patented by Dr. Zach Fung in 2016 and 2011 at the University of Utah with funding from the Department of Energy's ARPA-E program. Hyperion X now aims to successfully reach its own Bessemer moment as it commissions its first commercial titanium production facility using the HAMR process this year in Virginia.
Titanium is the only light metal that has the potential to replace steel, but it hasn't for the last 40, 60 years. It's not because people didn't know titanium has potential. People always know titanium is a wonderful metal and it has a lot of good properties, but it's just too expensive.
We're working to bring the price down so it's comparable to stainless steel. You know, the titanium market is something like $4 or $5 billion a year. The stainless steel market is like $105 billion a year, so about 100 times larger. If we can cut into just even a portion of that, it's a huge increase in the titanium world. As we bring the cost of titanium down, it will, hopefully trickle down to the end user, so they can get an implant for cheaper and can reach more people, perhaps even in third world countries or places that they don't have that access, that could become more possible.
Hyperion X has had several re-rating periods in its 3.5 years as a public company. The latest began last June 2023, when the company agreed a scope of work for the supply of titanium metal components for Ford Motor Company. Hyperion X followed up on this announcement with an order in August with Lockheed Martin for the delivery of titanium plate components. And again, in September, it executed a test services agreement with the U.S. Army, also for titanium plate components. On the raw material supply side, Iperion X secured new sources of titanium scrap feedstock through agreements with ELG Utica, part of the Aperam Group, and Hero DevTech, a leading aerospace supplier. Which brings us to the latest chapter in Iperion X's rise. On February 14th, the company announced significant progress in advancing its commercial-scale titanium manufacturing capabilities, which will be the main focus of today's discussion. Tazo, welcome to Rockstock Channel. It's hard to believe this is our first ever interview.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Howard. It was a long time.
So let's start with the macro of titanium, and also one of the most important mantras in commodity investing that we follow is that commodity equities follow commodity prices. We're going to go through a bunch of slides from your presentation. Mm-hmm. So what's the structure of the titanium market, and why have prices been rising?
In 2019, the last titanium metal sponge plant was announced that it was going to shut. Progressively over a few decades, the other sponge plants, or the other titanium metal, think of them as the crude steel of the titanium metal industry, titanium metal sponge, those plants shut. And so that was the impetus for starting Iperion X, to reassure a sustainable but also a secure and low-cost supply of titanium metal into the North American market. So what we have today, now that the last titanium metal sponge plants in the United States have all shut, is that we have a titanium metal market, or sponge market, or titanium, you know, primary metal market that is dominated by China and Russia, with over 70% of production, more than that in terms of capacity. And then the only Western world supply really is in Japan. And then when you go into subsets of that, of what used to supply commercial aerospace, and then some defense applications, was Russian, Japanese, and some Kazakhi, and Ukrainian supply. So today, with no capacity left for that refining metal in the United States, and with the outbreak of, the Russia-Ukraine war, which has put huge stringent, sanctions on the Russian supply into the US, still not into EU. EU still continues to import a lot of Russian titanium, but a lot of stringent supply, although we do still take some Russian titanium into the US here. You've had a market which has really come out of balance.
You know, you call it a commodity market. I think sponge potentially call, or you could call a commodity, but the end titanium metal products are really products. They're not commodity markets. And that's what we're striving towards, is significant products for our customers that help to lower the cost of the titanium metal that they buy today. We're now completely reliant, or over-reliant, on Japanese titanium metal sponge. It can't keep up. The alternatives is really for aerospace or defense components, high quality components, although the Chinese are getting better. They're mainly still an industrial, their titanium mainly still goes into the industrial market, but it is getting better and is starting to enter aerospace. But really, if you go, you know, back 10 years, it was really just Russia, Japan, Kazakhstan, Ukraine that could supply those critical markets. Knock out Russia, pretty much Kazakhstan is right there, landlocked between Russia and China. You've really just got Japan. You don't have Ukraine because there's a war. So now you're left with Japan trying to supply the entire Western world. And so you've had massive, issues there. And you've had price rises in the price of titanium. And then when you look at how Japan feeds its titanium sponge industry, is titanium mineral imports, mainly of rutile. And you've had supply shocks come out in the rutile market as well, with the closure of the largest, the Sierra Rutile mine in Sierra Leone, the largest titanium rutile mine in the world, 20%+ of global capacity. You now have this, you know, this really terrible multiple single points of failure type of structure, which, you know, when I started Piedmont Lithium, when you talk about electric vehicles, okay, if we don't have electric vehicles, you know, we can still have a defense industry. We don't have titanium, we don't have a defense industry.
There's one single point of failure for the United States today in the titanium metal market. It's Japan. And already their supply chain is starting to fail because of the rutile supply shorts. And so you have this precarious situation where you have, yes, rising prices because of the everything happened geopolitically, but you have a true strategic issue at hand, which is there will be no titanium if anything happened between China and Taiwan. And, you know, the structure of the titanium metal market, it's complex, it's pretty broken. And that's the whole reason we built or started this company.
Okay. And still sticking with this chart that you have here, you have three lines here of three different prices. You have the imported titanium scrap line, you have the exported titanium bar and rod line, and the exported semi-finished wrought titanium product line. So the scrap price looks to be, $8,000 or $10,000.
Yeah.
The exported titanium bar looks to be in, the $60,000 price. And then the exported semi-finished wrought iron, you know, is pushing, you know, $120,000. So you're talking about high value products. Your story at the outset, is to use the titanium scrap, which is that bottom line, right? And to make products, you know, in the yellow and the other line, is that broadly accurate? And then we'll go into more details in it, but is that generally the initial, thesis?
And what the ultimate goal is to take, you know, titanium metal scrap and eventually titanium minerals, which will come in for cheaper, but to go straight to the blue line. Straight to semi-wrought, semi-finished products, whether they're mill products or near net shapes that we can talk about later. And to pass through and not have to go through sponge, but especially not have to go through into those mill products that are like billet or rods or bars, go directly to what our customers want. But in the midterm or in the short term, probably we'll do both some bars, billets, if our customers want, but more than likely, you know, the idea is to go straight to semi-finished components that our customers can then take, and eventually lower that price in the long term.
Jumping in here from the editing room to tell you about Lithium Royalty Corp. Lithium Royalty Corp is at the center of a global energy transition and manages a globally diversified portfolio of lithium-focused royalties in electrification and decarbonization. With 32 royalties on 29 higher-grade, lower-cost projects from exploration to production, LIRC covers all the bases with well-managed risk, ESG considerations, and a scalable royalty structure. Lithium Royalty Corp is traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange, ticker symbol LIRC. To find out more, visit lithiumroyaltycorp.com.
Okay, we'll definitely get into more detail on all of those, but just again, the bars are... You're starting at the bottom line, right? You could see the margin between the differential and the prices there, but all three of those categories have been going up because of, you know, the supply shock from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So the backdrop is prices are rising, and we're going to get into the detail of how you're going to, you know, capture, you know, this margin. You have this slide here that shows the titanium market at $4 billion and then the aluminum market at $165 billion. And the stainless steel market at $200 billion. So this is the kind of, you know, the big, hairy, audacious goal that you seek to lower the price. I have here my iPhone, which originally I bought the iPhone with the three cameras, and I brought it home, and it was too heavy. Like, I was taking the pictures, I wanted the better camera, but I was walking around with it, and I said, this is just like too heavy. So I returned it. And then 6 months later, Apple kind of came out with the titanium version, and I went and immediately replaced it because of the lighter properties, you know, of titanium. But titanium, a lot of people know from bicycles or watches, or like titanium is always the premium price. If you want to spend more, right, you're going to get that better product, because just to explain again the properties of titanium. And why, if you can lower the cost, there'll be a switch from aluminum, you know, and the stainless steel, which that is the, you know, the $1 trillion opportunity here, right? That's the, you're going to start with, just comparing it to Elon Musk. Elon Musk, like, prepared his roadster, right? Which is what you're doing with your first plants here in Virginia. But then the subsequent steps are significantly lowering the cost and then being able to make products that can then displace some of the heavier, you know, and more expensive, you know, steel and aluminum.
Think of it as if we had titanium metal cheap enough today, or if we had it cheap enough back when stainless steel was starting to be developed and starting to be introduced, we would never have stainless. But because it's titanium metal is sort of 40%+ lighter than stainless steel. But importantly as well, titanium and specifically its alloys are far stronger than stainless steel. So Ti-64 can be, so titanium-64, which is the main aerospace alloy, alloyed with vanadium and aluminum, is typically, you know, 3 to 4 times as strong as your average stainless steel. But then when you go, stainless steel is stainless, it's corrosion resistant. When you look at the corrosion resistance of Ti-64 or titanium metal alloys in general, it's far more corrosion resistant. There's an example that Dr. Fung gives. I'm in Salt Lake City right now. If you ever come to Salt Lake City, and I think Dr. Fung gave this example to you, Harold, when you were out here many years ago. If you take a crude steel and put it in the ocean, it would corrode in, you know, 3-4 months. And we're actually doing this in the lab right now here in our pilot facilities. You then put stainless steel in seawater in the ocean, that's going to probably corrode in about 5 years. So it's corrosion resistant, but it eventually does corrode in that chloride environment. You put titanium metal in the ocean, it never corrodes. So you come back 1,000 years later, nothing's happened.
But Tozo, essentially what you're describing here, and we've always discussed this, is there's incredible price elasticity for titanium. The demand function, you know, if you drop the price, it's highly, highly geared.
Yes. If you drop price, even if you drop price 20-30%, as we've been talking to some defense, some people in the defense supply chain or the defense industrial base here in the United States, if you drop, you know, the cost of the titanium metal bolt by 30%, you're going to get immense uptake of titanium metal bolts, you know, could be producing hundreds, if not millions of them. Getting that ingot into a final part, like a watch case, your final watch case or your final smartwatch case, you're probably less than 5% yield. So you're paying these high prices, like we're on those semi-finished components, $120 a kilo, to get only 5% of that into a product. The rest is scrap. So if we can bridge the gap on lower cost titanium metal refining, and then the lower cost forming of near net shape products to reduce and increase that yield to final product, you do a lot in bringing down the cost. And you only need to bring it down 20, 30, 40%, but if we can bring it down 70, 80%, all of a sudden you're going to have mass uptake of titanium metal in a lot of new applications.
So Tozo, I know so the Kroll process has been around for a long time. I don't want to go into necessarily the details of, you know, that flow sheet, yep, why it's bad, but you just said the yields are very, you know, low. It's expensive. It's high energy intensive. But mm-hmm. Here's a flow sheet we're putting up here with your hammer refining technology and your HSBT forging technology. But also from an ESG sustainability characteristic point of view, you're starting with completely recycled materials. You know,
that's a good one, Howard. That's another thing in that when you create the generation of titanium metal scrap through the machining process, creates fine titanium metal scrap, and we take a lot of scrap in that cannot be remelted into titanium metal. It's typically downcycled in the steel industry as an alloying element, and so you have probably 50 to 60% of the titanium metal scrap actually being able to be remelted. So we can create full circularity for the titanium metal supply chain. It's a high value metal, so you want as much circularity as you can. It's a high carbon intensity metal, so the more circularity you can have, the better. So we can bring full circularity to the titanium and supply chain. You can take in pretty much almost any scrap and recycle it. And that's what we're starting off today. With the added benefit of never using any direct carbon emissions in our process.
The flow chart again shows the prices, you know, the titanium scrap, $3,000 to $15,000 a ton going in, you know, refining into titanium powders, which range from 75 to 200,000, you know, then forging, which goes into kind of near net shapes, you know, $200,000 plus. And then you have like this additive manufacturing. So, but when we go later in this discussion to the Bell Potter kind of model in your techno-economic study, there's some presumption of sales of spherical powders, angular powders. You know, what are those? What are near net shapes? What is additive manufacturing? You know, why is that an important customer segment? And how much of these are commoditized products that you'll just produce and sell? And how much are bespoke products?
Our customers want us to be as close to the final shape as possible, especially the new customers. And I'll say this, we as a company, we're splitting the target markets that we're going out for into three real markets. One is the traditional markets of traditional defense and aerospace, which is the mill products, machine, low yields, what they call buy-to-fly, which is the inverse of the yield. So like a 10% yield is a 10 to 1 buy-to-fly ratio. Then you've got another market, which was growing even without us coming and building our business in line with the cost of titanium metal. And that was in consumer electronics and green hydrogen, which needs to use a lot of titanium metal in the PEM electrolyzers. That was a market which has come up in the last few years and is growing. And on both accounts, both consumer electronics and green hydrogen, those could be enormous markets in the next 5 years. But then there's the markets that we're going to develop by knowing the cost of titanium metal market, those markets that we can substitute our stainless steel and aluminum. Now, in the first market, the traditional market, they're used to more used to the traditional products. They are coming around to looking at new products, new near net shapes, especially in the defense side of the business. But they've traditionally been buying bars and rods and plates and machining those into components.
So it sounds like the angular powders and the spherical powders are more traditional, intermediate, maybe more commoditized products, where the near net shapes are very bespoke, customized, and
very
the customer
relationship.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll just touch on that because it might look like it's small. Like for some near net shape components, you might get multiples of $200,000 a ton, $200 a kilo. But here, and it might not make sense that a customer would see that and go, that's lower cost. But let's take an example of a watch case. So a titanium metal watch case that say is 25 grams when it's finished today starts from about a 300 plus gram titanium metal puck, I would say a round puck. You might pay $100 a kilo for that puck, right? But you're only using less than 10, close to 5% of that puck in the end, about 5 to 10% of that puck in the final titanium metal watch case. Some titanium metal watch cases are 12 grams you see in the industry. So you can be at sort of 5% of that original titanium metal. So you're buying 20 times the amount. So really in that final titanium metal watch case, you're paying $100 a kilo times 300 grams. But you're really dividing it over only say 15 grams of a watch case. So because you're getting, so it's 20, really 20 times the cost when you look at it. It's 20 times 100, it's $2,000 a kilo, really in that final watch case. So if we can produce a near net shape, which goes and it ends up being 30 grams, right? Or 50 grams or 100 grams, you've just cut it down a hell of a lot. So all of a sudden, say if we can get to a point where it's a 3 to 1 ratio, but we charge $200 or $300 a kilo, then the end product has got $1,000 worth of titanium in it, for instance. So it's $1,000 a kilo. So we've actually dropped it by half, but we're charging per kilo more because what happens is that our customer all of a sudden buys 60-70% less titanium metal. So they can pay more. And then they get the benefits of less machining time, so less time to actually manufacture the end product, and the sustainability benefits. So it's not intuitive that we could charge more for near-net shapes, but it is when you take into account that you are cutting a significant amount of scrap out of the system. You're improving their yields, not by a few percentage points. You're improving their yields by an order of magnitude, right? You go from 5% yield to 50, 60% yield, right? In your final products. Then over time, in the next few years, we can charge that $200 a kilo. But imagine over time, we drop that $200 a kilo to $50 a kilo because we're producing, I don't know, 50, 100,000 tons of titanium metal per hour. All of a sudden, then you've done the math. You're making titanium metal watch cases, for instance, or smartphone cases or smartwatch cases for a fraction of stainless steel. So why would you ever use a stainless steel? Probably should use an aluminum case in that point. So this is where we're going.
One comment I would make is I just remember reading maybe 5-10 years ago in The Economist, they had these kind of like future technologies and electric vehicles and batteries were like one component. And then they had a whole separate segment about like 3D printing. So you're always hearing like 3D printing, it's the future, you know, but how do you play 3D printing? I mean, what you're describing is the shapeability of titanium with your process into these near net shapes. If you lower the cost of it, you know, these component 3D printing enables the manufacturing of those processes to be significantly cheaper, you know, but your product being shapeable is part of the scalability of the 3D printing industry. Is that a fair
Absolutely.
Analysis?
It is. 3D printing is wanting to go directly into the final product form as close as you can, directly into near-net shapes. And that's why 3D printing is there. It's to cut down on the machine time needed in final products. So whether we feed into 3D printing, where the ink for the printers, we like to think of it as that, or whether we feed directly through our HSPT process into near net shapes, because in both cases, whether you 3D print or go through our HSPT process, you can end up with near net shapes. We are advancing manufacturing. We're taking manufacturing from, you know, what it was 50 years ago to the future, where we're going directly into products, directly into more complex products. And able to lower the cost of those products substantially. So absolutely, we're the ink for the printers of the future, but we also have a process which can lower the cost of traditional products as well, substantially.
Tarzo, if you could just walk through in terms of what's happening with these buildings and how they're related.
Yes. So we've been operating an industrial pilot facility here in Salt Lake City, where I am right now, for a few years now. We secured the technology, started looking at the technology in 2020, secured the technology in 2021. And then we took over operations of the industrial, what we call our industrial pilot facility, at the start of 2022. Very quickly, we realized the scale we needed to have a new building and to, you know, bring in new equipment and scale to the next step. Already what we're doing here is done at a much larger scale than with typical pilot facilities in other commodities, whether it's lithium or rare earths or anything like that. But we quickly identified that we wanted to scale. So we went through a site selection process in 2022, ended up choosing Virginia because of strong state support, financial support and incentive, but also strong support from the governor and the senators of Virginia to locate in Virginia. And we chose an area which had which is an industrial technology park, which wants advanced manufacturing jobs. It's in South Boston, Virginia, so Halifax County, 3 hours away from Washington, D.C. But we chose this location because it had this existing building. We call it the 10-acre building of our titanium production facility. 50,000 square foot built for the intent purpose of $4 million building, built for the intent purpose of securing advanced manufacturing jobs. So we secured that building initially as the scale-up building for the process to manufacture, the hammer process, really, to manufacture titanium metal powders. As we started working on that, we realized that we also wanted to have, over 2023, we realized, and as we were working with our customers, like you said, we announced Ford, we announced Lockheed Martin, we announced GKN Aerospace, and Canyon Bicycles. We've got multiple groups that we're prototyping for or selling low volume production into, like with Panerai, part of the Richemont group. We decided, look, we need a better location as well to be able to take those powders and either use our HSPT process to make milk, to make bars or near-net shapes, or use 3D printing to make 3D printed products for our customers. And so during last year, we were able to secure the 1092 building, and we call that our advanced manufacturing center. And this is what will house the ability for us to take our powders and turn it into shapes and forms, whether it's near-net shapes or traditional mill products or 3D printed products that our customers are either going to buy, well, they'll always buy from us, but they'll either use for prototyping or low volume production runs. And this is really where people will get excited. We have three 3D printers in there already. We have our furnaces in there. We have our testing capabilities in there, advanced R&D in there. We have our offices in there. I think most of the equipment is in, but by the end of April, this would be, it's starting. We're going to start operating some equipment end of April, start of May. You know, most of the equipment is turned on and being commissioned, being, you know, the first runs being done. So it really is a flagship for us to showcase how we can take scrap in one location, goes into the 1080 building, out comes powders, and how those powders can go directly into parts. So it's very much a showcase, a flagship. It will generate revenue, but it would also be a flagship for not just investors to see what we do, but more important, but just as importantly, US government officials and our military contacts. We will be dealing with defense industry base significantly because of the strategic need right now for titanium metal. We have a lot of military intersect. The 1080 building has been funded by the Defense Production Act Title III program, by the Department of Defense, the Defense Logistics Agency. So we do have a big intersect there with military, and showing military, showing US government officials, showing our customers, and then showing our investors what we do is going to be a big thing in them understanding how we can really upend the titanium metal supply chain. Pictures paint 1,000 words, as you guys know. This is going to be an amazing flagship facility. I'm very excited about it. An 80 building is going to be the back half this year. There's equipment being installed in there. It's a much bigger build. This is where titanium production will go through the hammer process. The furnace is arriving very soon into the building that undertakes the hammer process. It's a very off-the-shelf furnace. We ran an equivalent sized furnace in the manufacturer's facilities in the Netherlands last year twice in full load. So we've already really proven that it works. But to install it in Virginia and start running it mid-year and producing powders will be, in my thoughts, that Bessemer moment for a lot of people. All right, this works at an industrial scale. This is not something where it's, you know, you're tinkering around in the lab, and we never have been, even in our industrial pilot facility. But you walk into this and this is a major, you know, industrial commercial scale furnace, which if we wanted to, it's cookie cutter. We could just, you know, in modules, build another 10 of them and
I was going to ask that. So you could scale as simple as that with modular. So Tarzo, who at Aperion X is responsible for selling company products? What market segments do you think will make up the bulk of Aperion X's revenue in the next few years? You know, is it defense, aerospace, automotive, consumer electronics, you know, luxury goods, or is it a pretty even split?
I think defense is going to be larger than we initially thought, just because of some initiatives for lightweighting within the defense industrial base and because of the, you know, scarcity of titanium metal products from secure locations today. We see, you know, consumer electronics, green hydrogen being a big growth sector for us, where we can feed into. We see the ability to go into, you know, not just luxury goods, but other goods in general, which had used titanium metal in the past, you know, bicycle industry, automotive industry. Automotive is actually going to be bigger than what I thought as well. We've got quite a lot of prototyping going on with Ford Motor Company right now, which I think is some very cool parts actually. I don't think it's not going to be an even
split. I think in a decade out, it's probably more of an even split. It probably skews towards consumer electronics, automotive, micro mobility as well. But I think it's going to be more defense aerospace. Commercial aerospace will take a while, just because of the qualification processes. They want that product to be out there for a bit. But automotive, consumer electronics, luxury goods, green hydrogen, they're going to be big markets for us in the future, and could be pretty big in the coming times as well. So I, you know, travel a lot together with our president, Toby Simons, my chief commercial officer, Dominic Allen. You know, everyone gets involved. Our chairman, Todd Hannigan, is I've been very close with for over a decade now. He even gets involved in strategic discussions, whether it's with the US government and the defense and the DOD, or whether it's with some of these strategic customers. So we take it upon ourselves to develop those strategic customers.
Which way around does it work? Do you have the orders? Do you get approached, or do you design something and then approach potential customers?
Sometimes customers have approached us. In a few of the customers that we've announced and customers that we've yet to announce, they've approached us because they're looking for the sustainability or the lower cost or the full circularity. Because we can take 100% scrap and the current industry cannot take 100% scrap titanium metal. But typically it goes into, okay, let's do a scope of work for either a prototyping engagement where they pay for the prototypes, or a scope of work for low volume production runs. And so it very quickly moves into purchase orders for those prototype products or those, or that low volume production runs. So we have orders, we have purchase orders that we feed into, but we also are moving with some customers, you know, that we have a scope of work purchase order to do prototype production parts that will then lead into future longer term sales agreements, like what we're more used to in the lithium industry, for instance, where we'll be a longer term offtake style agreement. We still like to call it a sales agreement because it's very simple. It's just a sale of our titanium metal.
I guess, you know, you've explained it. I guess this is slightly different because of the nature of your model, but in terms of how comfortable are you in securing your raw supplies for the future, the scrap material, you know, as you grow and expand?
Yeah, it's a good question, Rodney. The scrap market has gotten tighter because of China and Russia. And the Russian invasion of Ukraine, with, you know, now a much less Russian titanium metal coming into the US. The US melters of titanium sponge have tried to increase the amount of scrap they melt to account for the less, you know, titanium metal coming in from Russia. It's pushed up some scrap prices, but again, they can only really focus on scrap that is low oxygen. So there's a subset, there's just scrap that incumbent industry cannot take, and it's going into the steel sector mainly, or sometimes going out into landfill. And so we focus on that scrap, which is typically, you know, not fully circular, which is downsized. And so there is a lot of that out there for our ambitions over the next few years. There's a lot of it out there for 2,000, potentially even 10,000, 20,000 tons per annum. The titanium metal scrap generated yearly in the United States is 60,000 tons per annum. So it's not like the lithium industry today, which I'll go back to and I can reference a lot because you guys know it so well. You still don't have a lot of batteries coming back and being recycled. You don't have a lot of recycling need. Like, you don't have a lot of scrap supply in the lithium industry yet because it's still growing, still nascent. In titanium metal, that's not the case. There's a huge amount of scrap generation. We're not going to stop at 10,000 tons. We're going to keep on going. And so at some point we will run out of cheap scrap, or we will run out of scrap in general. If we were able to do 100,000 tons of titanium metal, we won't have enough scrap for that. So that's where, and that's the whole reason why I always wanted the minerals coming from that. You know, we have that backward integration. You have, you know, already defined over a 25-year timeframe, 60,000-70,000 tons per annum of titanium metal over a 25-year time span out of the Titan project. So we can backward integrate and just continue to grow a 5,000 ton per annum facility and say we drop price to $50 a kilo, that's still $250 million of revenue. Our margins are going to be, you know, really big, 60-70% or more. And I'm then not worried then about building a mine and backward integrate. But do I want to do it now, build a $200 million mine, or do I build a business in a modular way, capital efficient way, on scrap, take as much scrap as I can at a cheap price, create circularity into the titanium metal supply chain, you know, get our revenues to $200-300 billion a year, and then backward integrate? That's I think the way to go. Modular expansion, don't bite off too much, get up to making a lot of money, you know, making big margins, and then use that margin, use that cash flow to build out our next, you know, to continue to build out our supply chain.
Those are all very good points. I remember Reg last week in his summary talked about you having, you know, $300 million of EBITDA at some point and maybe capturing, you know, 4 or 5% of the U.S. titanium market. But we have the Bell Potter summary here, which I just want to, you know, if you could help us walk through a little bit. They have an NPV of, you know, about $700 million. And it basically shows titanium scrap as your input cost, and then spherical powder, angular powder as your products. And, you know, from 2027, it shows like $124 million of EBITDA and then just flat. Obviously, they're not focusing on any growth there. But this was based on a techno-economic assessment, you know, that you had put together. So if you could just talk through, you know, what they're telling there, this underpins their $3, $70 target.
We have small revenues now, but yeah, significantly more revenues and significant cash flow over the next few years. I'll start though, Howard, with saying, look, really pleased with both Reg Spencer, Canaccord, and Stuart Howard at Bell Potter. I've known both for a while now. You know, obviously Reg covered Piedmont Lithium. He's both are fantastic analysts, you know, great team there as well. But I think both of them took approaches which is very reasonable. Reg Spencer, for instance, built in more growth into the future. Stuart Howe decided to not do that and just focus on the initial 2,000 tons and then, you know, add a value for potential future growth. When you look at this one here, and similar to Reg Spencer's, you have to break it out into different products that will sell spherical powders. You know, how much will it sell at that? How much angular powder we're going to take and sell direct? How much angular powder we're going to take and have value adding with HSPT into the near-net shapes? And then what the prices of those products will be. That's the hardest one of prices of what the products would be. You can assume a product mix, but then, you know, price is there. I think it's reasonable. Both of them have had a reasonable approach. They've taken our techno-economic assessment, used the numbers that we guided people to around, you know, what HAMR's going to cost, what HSPT's going to cost, to end up with you know, the valuations that they came out with. You know, I'm not going to comment directly on what they had. They've got their assumptions. I think their assumptions are sound, and I think people should take the time to read through both the if they have access to it, both the Canaccord and the Bell Potter research report. I think they're well put together. But in the end, as a company, we are to fulfill the needs of our customers, and for what we want for our shareholders to maximize value, we are going for as much value add as we can. And I think that, you know, I would love to be able to exceed those, the numbers that we've put out there. And, you know, when we're up and running, I would like to be able to bring forward cash flow as much as we can. And I would be, you know, wanting to maximize that EBITDA that we have from what we're targeting to operate out of. And we've put publicly there that by 2026, we want to be at the run rate of 2,000 tons per annum. So we're fully funded to get up to the initial, what we stated was 125 metric tons per annum run rate at the initial phase one of Virginia facilities. That's, you know, full speed ahead already. Most of the equipment's been bought. A lot of the outfit of the building is there. It was a $25 million build in the end, $5 million coming out of the state and county, $13 million, around about $13 million is coming from the DOD. You know, we raised, like you said, $100 million Aussie dollars, to develop the tech and, develop these operations. So we're well into that phase one. We'll start producing at the 125 metric tons per annum, probably going to be more, but we'll start producing, you know, mid year from that and be fully scaled by the end of the year in phase one. But then taking that phase one and then during a modular approach to go, then going to phase two, we've put out there that it's about a $70 million capital number. Now we're refining that number. We're going through a more detailed, you know, essentially definitive feasibility study right now for that scale up to 2,000 tons per annum. And we'll come out with numbers, hopefully mid-year, that will help dollars. How do you fund that to get to 2,000 tons per annum? We've been the first company and the first process in probably two decades that the government, or over a decade at least, that the government's funded to try to reshore the titanium metal refining part of the process. It's sort of like we're the chosen ones in the current geopolitical environment that the government's chosen to try and reshore the titanium metal supply chain. So, we're doing it now. It's not like they've chosen us and we're going to do it in 3 years' time. We're doing it right now. We've got, I can say that we've had, we have extremely strong relationships with our US government officials. I was just in DC a few weeks ago, meeting our congressional delegations. This is 40 meetings we had across 4 days, meeting everything from our congressional representatives through to our senators, senators in other states that are supportive of what we're doing, the defense industrial base are meeting, you know, admirals and colonels and, you know, people like that within the defense industrial base that want to see our products in the defense industrial base. So we've got immense support from the US government and the defense industrial base to reshore, to have our technology reshore a secure source of titanium metal. Last year, there was a request for information put out by the Defense Logistics Agency's IBAS program or agency, which is Industrial Base Assessment and Sustainment, part of the Defense Logistics Agency. This is a big pool of money, bigger pool of money than the Defense Production Act, Title III program, which focuses on secure supply chains for defense industry. And they specifically called out the want to reshore between 100 to 200 tons a month, so 1,200 to 2,400 tons per year of titanium metal capacity using a new process, ideally with a company that has an existing metal or access to a mineral supply chain that avoids the coil process and can produce, you know, near net shape products, powders for additive manufacturing or traditional metal products. I don't see any other company that has all that vertically integrated than us. We are one of one. We have no competition when it comes down to that. When it comes down to vertical integration in the Western world titanium supply chain, or globally, we are one of one. We are the only ones that can achieve that. Now, that needs to go to an RFP, and we believe that is one show of support of the US government future funding. So we see that $70 million being potentially heavily funded as we're successful, by US government and US government funding, or by loan funding from the US government, the Export Import Bank. We're going through a process right now to secure $11 million of equipment financing for phase one. And that's definitely can be segued into equipment finance phase two as well. So you could see that number be very low. In addition to that, we've got strategic customers there that could be funders or the scale up of our process. So look, we are, you know, this is a business, we run a business, we want healthy balance sheet. We want to make sure that we're taking advantage of opportunities in the market. But we see, and we will do the right thing by our shareholders, because we are shareholders as well. We are the big shareholders. So we're definitely behind, you know, minimal dilution, maximize as much of these grants and grant funding that's out there, from the US government today, And so I do see a pathway where there's minimal need for cash flow coming in from us to fund our scale up. But all that's going to be sorted out in the next 18 months. We don't need to start on phase two until sort of, you know, second, third quarter next year to be operational 2026. So right now the focus is let's serve our existing customers. Let's announce more of our customers that we've been working with. Let's get into cash, into significant revenue generation from phase one. And then everything else is going to easily fall into place. Let's show the government that that we're a good investment of defense funds as well by getting it up and running. You know, we were only allocated Defense Production Act Title III grant in November, and already some of our defense colleagues are saying, geez, you guys are almost going to be operational. So that's, they see us as successful, they're going to want to back you. They're just like investors. Think of them just as investors. If they're seeing that their investment is paying off, they're going to want to follow their investment. Let's execute this year and into next year. And then I think we're going to see so many opportunities open for us for further growth into the future, or for non-dilutionary growth, capital needs into the future. So that was a long-winded way of answering that question.
And Toza, so from here on in, timelines and process and what's needed and wanted for final investment decision? Mm-hmm.
What we like to say is that capital spending is very much focused on the technology, because the technology allows us to unlock all of that potential from the minerals. So we need to develop, and we've been funded by the government and by our recent equity raises to focus on scaling this technology. That's where our institutional investors want us to be. They see the benefit of the backward integration, but they want to see, you know, how we really change the game, how we revolutionize the titanium industry with our technologies. The capital spending is focused on that right now. So what we've done with the Titan project is we've shown a technological assessment, a scoping study of how big it can be. We've taken it through permitting, so big tick in the box there, and shown that there's significant minerals in the ground there. This is the Saudi Arabia of titanium out here. There's a lot more we can get out here as we grow. And then importantly, we also did the feasibility level metallurgical test work to show that the mineral sands from here can easily be extracted, and we can easily produce the titanium minerals. We've got the rare earth minerals there as well, and the zircon minerals, the high value minerals that we can then use in our business as well. So right now, the focus is on that more capital efficient scale up, that modular scale up of the titanium metal technologies. You know, we put $200 or $300 million over the next, say, 5 years into the titanium metal business. So we could have, you know, multiples of that in cash flow. So that's where the focus is today. Is on that capital efficient scale up. But then eventually, like what we talked about, we run out of scrap and we want to backward integrate. When we're backward integrating, we need to spend money on building a mine. So there's that big CapEx, or that larger CapEx check there that I'm not scared about in 5 years' time. If we're making, like on Reg Spencer's note, $300 million for Ilkerbuck, it's going to be easy to fund that. Is $200-$250 million. We can probably do that in phases. But once you backward integrate, the scrap cost, in my opinion, could go to zero. That raw feedstock, because all of a sudden, you know, you're not paying for scrap, you're extracting the minerals out of the ground. And the byproducts of the rare earth minerals and the zircon minerals, which will sell into the existing market, you know, obviously rare earths and zircon minerals are high value. They could pay for the raw feedstock that then feeds the Hamlet process. So what it does is we spend more capital, but we probably continue to significantly lower our feedstock cost. The cost of titanium metal scrap within the $30 or $40 a kilo we put out there to market on the manufacturing of titanium metal is about a quarter. So that's an easy line item that we could almost eliminate backward integrating. So while it's less capital efficient right now for us to develop it, it will be at some point the right way to go in the future. We need to, it's a strategic asset for us now. We can always backward integrate it. And if anything happened in the South China Sea, we can bring it online very quickly to replace the lost capacity we'll have from Japan. But over the longer term, without a conflict in the South China Sea, we'll eventually backward integrate it. And all it will do is just continue to allow us to drive that price and that cost and that eventual price of titanium metal down to our customer.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense, but it's a very huge component. So you're basically saying the Titan project is dependent on, you know, you're ramping the downstream up to what amount of tons can you source from scrap? Is it 10,000? Is it like right now you're going to 2,000, but like at what level do you then turn on the mine?
Technically you could source, you know, the entire scrap generated in the US is 60,000 tons from it. But you're going to start competing. The high value scrap today in the market is $15, $16 a kilo. Low value scrap like that, which is downcycled to the market, you can sometimes get for $1 a kilo. So, you know, there's a point there where we go, okay, you know, do we want to take that high value scrap in the future, you know, which is about 50% of the market? Probably not. How much of the scrap that's going to the steel industry do we take before it pushes the price of that scrap up as well? So it's a bit of a, you know, it's a demand supply balance. We're bringing on new demand for that low value scrap. And so we're going to push up the price at some. Right now we're not, because we're too small. Do we start pushing that price in at 10,000 or 20,000 tons? We're still yet to see how elastic or inelastic that curve is, that price curve would be. We'll still have to see. Right now we've had no effect on prompt because we're still small.
I want to go into the kind of catalyst slide. So Tazo, you mentioned your board and Todd Hannigan as executive chairman. He has written significant checks multiple times at early stages and subsequent rounds, but have a lot of respect for him. He was a huge shareholder in Piedmont and a board member. And I've been communicating with him, you know, just about the strategic nature, you know, of this business. But just to frame it for all of our viewers, how he thinks about it, you know, Reg Spencer said that titanium is more important and strategic, you know, to the U.S. than rare earths, you know, and lithium. You know, but if you think about it from a lithium perspective, he was saying like what would happen if a lithium company could produce not only lithium hydroxide at half the cost of other producers, but also could manufacture batteries at less than half the cost? What would happen to the sector? How large and sustainable would the margins be? In his view, Hyperion X isn't incremental. It's an extinction event for traditional producers, and it will lead to an explosion in titanium demand. The only thing holding back the market is high cost titanium. The metal and its alloys are clearly the superior choice for strength, weight, durability, and control and corrosion resistance. But he's clearly drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, that's what he thinks. You know, so Hank Reardon, you know, Tazo Arima, let's just put up the catalyst slide for the rest of this year here. What should we look forward to for the remainder of the year to drive further shareholder value?
It's great. Jeez, I love Todd. He's just everything. Really is. It's just so good. You know, I'll try and, you know, in private conversations, would I use the word extinction event? You know, you knew me from coal spur days where, you know, there was people telling me you couldn't rail coal from Alberta to the coast. That's the largest export thermal coal mine in North America today. And this will be a complete upending of the titanium supply chain. And if people think they're going to be secure in that, you know, we need to qualify product into certain markets, so be it. They will be for a few years. But at some point, if we've, you know, halved or quartered the cost of titanium metal, eventually the whole industry comes to us. And if that 5 years, is that 10 years? I'm not too sure. But that's what we're aiming for here. And that's where we see it going. And, you know, skeptics, you know, yeah, they can be skeptics. I really don't mind about it. But this is a complete revolution in titanium metal supply chain. There was many skeptics when steel came along
I think this is one of those events where, you know, we're going to bring about titanium metal that is going to really change the way we look at types of materials which you use in our average products that we use every day. That's over the long term. That's over the next 5, 10, 20 years. And that's why it's so exciting for me to be in the position that I am. We've got to continue to keep an eye on the future, but we have to execute on the near-term objectives as well. And it's a delicate balance because we've got, you know, resources that we've got to allocate to both long-term projects, short-term projects, medium-term projects. And we've got to do what we can with the resources that we have at hand, both human resources and capital resources as well. So in the short term, and by short term in the next 12 months, is the scale up and execution on, in Virginia and delivering more product to our customers and, for both prototyping, but also low volume and mid volume production runs, depending on the product sale. So that's ongoing, you know, and that's why in the CEO letter, I've really focused on, we turn on this plant, we've put to bed any skepticism about us being able to scale this business. It's over, because this is then modular from then on. So the next 3-4 months of that build out and that initial commissioning is so important, because if you commission that plant, like if you go into a sponge plant, there's 60 furnaces. With the sponge plant we visited was 60 furnaces to do 10,000, to do 9,200 tons, of which 8,000 tons was, you know, the grade that you could put into the titanium metal industry. 60 furnaces. We did 60 furnaces of, this one will be the equivalent, right? And will be half the cost. Those furnaces are far more expensive. But there's ability for us to take this existing same furnace and same model. It's like just buying, you know, a model of a stove and saying, I'm just going to buy it 3 times bigger. It's exactly the same thing. No change in the critical dimensions of what we're doing to in the reaction. So, you know, we should buy 20 furnaces then to do what we do. And then there's furnaces that get even bigger from there that are less off the shelf, but still pretty, pretty standard. So turning on the facility puts to bed any questions that this is a scale business. And then at the same time, with the 1092 building, being able to take that product and manufacture high value titanium metal products, whether it's, you know, the traditional plates and bars, or whether it's near net shapes or 3D printed products for our customers, is so important, because it builds on the existing customer relationships we have. So more revenue from those existing relationships. But then in addition to that, it develops those customers that we've been talking with for a long time now and bring them to the forefront. Some very high value customers, very large customers in different industries, whether it's consumer electronics, whether it's automotive, whether it's green hydrogen, whether it's the defense industrial base as well. So it's this next real 3-6 months is huge on that. Over the next 12 months, we're fully commissioning everything. We're fully up and running at the 125 metric ton per annum run rate. And then we're continuing to secure those customers and getting ready for that larger scale build or that scale up, that phase two, into over 2,000 metric tons per annum. And at that point, over the next, say, 12 months, 18 months, the catalysts are continue to secure those customers and just execute again on those operations, making cash flow, and execute on scaling the business with, you know, long-term sales agreements with, you know, strategic large customers. You know, you noted GM there in with Lithium Americas. I mean, we have Ford Motor Company there who could be an enormous customer. And I don't think I can comment on the amount and types of parts that we're producing and looking to include in vehicles, but I can say that it's a real, you know, there will be our titanium metal in Ford Motor Company vehicles in the near future. There's customers which are much or well-known companies which are far larger than that who use titanium metal, who want sustainable titanium metal, who want American-made titanium metal. And with us being the lowest cost, we're the clear advantage. So, you know, we're going to have multiple very large-scale, very strategic customers that we're already working with that are going to be our long-term customers, long-term partners in this vision of reshoring a sustainable low-cost titanium metal supply chain in the US. So we're really excited about that. There's a lot in there, a lot of, you know, milestones that we see that, you know, some of which we announce or are announceable milestones that will, we think will drive de-risking in the eyes of investors. Whether that drives the share price rise is up to the investor. But for me, there's multiple points in the next 6 and 12 months, which just de-risks our vision, you know, our grandiose vision continues to de-risk it.
So Tazo, I'm looking at this stock chart here. This is your ADS, not ADR, ADS. I'm glad to be a shareholder, but like I just should have sold all my lithium stocks a year ago and put it into Hyperion X, hindsight's 2020. But looking at, you know, so your ADS is like $15, you know, that's like a real stock. It's price. It's not a penny stock. Your share count is not that big, 224 million. This isn't like a billion share kind of Aussie company, but your liquidity is actually not that much. The stock's going up. Like I'm looking at this, $2 million a day. And this is, seems to be a function of a very tight share register, you know, insider ownership of 30%, you know, Fidelity, yeah. Two different arms of Fidelity own 10% each. So there's basically 50% float. You know, you've raised like lots of capital, 350, we've seen this lots of times before in like micro cap stories, right? They become super liquid over time at much higher valuations. That actually happened to Lithium Americas with their New York Stock Exchange listing. You know, it happened with Piedmont. I remember the $2 billion traded that one day when the Tesla deal was announced, but that liquidity event, you know, hasn't yet happened, you know, in your shares, but therein lies an opportunity. Let's leave it at that. Thank you for taking so much time for this very detailed analysis of a very exciting story. Like I said, even though it's up 20 times in 3.5 years, you know, you got a 20-year time horizon here. This is like, when I think about, you know, Elon Musk and lots of private companies, you know, they do Series A, Series B, Series C round financings, et cetera. They do all that privately, and there's not much scope. You know, for a retail investor, you know, if you're buying Facebook, you're buying Uber, you're buying something else, like it comes out, it's 10 billion market cap. It's like 20 billion market cap. Here, you could still participate, you know, in a 300 million market cap company with, you're building your Roadster, like right now, like that plant is like Tesla Roadster.
It's a good analogy.
That's where you are. Okay. Take care.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Okay.
Thanks, Tazo.